here with Pat Halloran. Why don't you take us back to the beginning? How'd you get interested in flying in the first place?
Well, I guess the reason I got into aviation was because of the Korean War. I was about to get drafted, and I was visiting with a recruiter over. I'm from Minnesota, and I was up in Minneapolis, and I was visiting a recruiter with the intent of going in the Army because they had the shortest term, and you could get out in 18 months and get the GI Bill. And I was waiting for the recruiter to finish. He was talking to somebody else, and I was just sitting in the chair, and I looked across the room, and there was an Air Force recruiter, and they had just changed to blue uniforms, and man, he looked spiffy. And so I said, God, that looks nice. So I just went over to chat with him, and with no intention of doing anything serious. 30 minutes later, I was in the Air Force.
They got you.
They got me. And I'd never flown an airplane in my life. And he said, well, with your college and such, you qualify to be an aviation cadet. And I said, what's that? He said, well, we'll train you to be a pilot. You'll get a commission to be an officer and fly airplanes. And that sounded like a hell of a good deal. So I said, okay, you got me. And it worked out from there. So from that point on, I was aviation directed.
All right. What was your first assignment with the Air Force?
Well, I went to basic pilot training down at Perrin Air Force Base in Texas. That's at Sherman, Texas. It's not an Air Force base anymore. But I was fortunate enough here about 2 months ago. I was in Texas, and I landed back at that same base to visit some friends. And I was on downwind leg, and I looked down that runway, and I says, God, 60 years ago, I was on this downwind leg flying a T-6. What has remarkable change? So the first airplane in basic training in those days was the T-6. Later on, I think they went back to some smaller airplanes as a feed-in. And, of course, in World War II, a T-6 was an advanced trainer. But they started us out in the T-6. And that's a pretty big airplane for your first airplane. But if you don't know any better, if you never flew an airplane, you said, okay, I guess this is the way it works.
That's kind of an interesting perspective. Most of us, these days, start in the smaller airplanes and move our way up and look at someone who's flying a T-6 as someone who's very advanced, has a lot of experience, able to take care of that big old tailwheel airplane, but you're right.
Either a lot of guts or very dumb, a combination of both, maybe.
So there you go. As an aviation cadet, you didn't know any better and didn't matter to the airplane either.
No, it didn't matter, and I didn't wrap any of them up, and I didn't have any accidents, so I thought, well, this is a pretty cool thing.
Yeah. Any incidents or unusual things that happened during your training that kind of stick out in your mind?
No, not on the T-6. I don't recall anything significant happening. The training went pretty well as programmed, and at the end of that training, of course, that's when you get selected for your advanced trainer. And in those days, there were just two schools. You either went to multi-engine, which was B-25s, or you became a jet pilot. And of course, naturally, we all wanted to be jet pilots because jets were brand new. And I made the cut for the jet training.
So you're in the T-6. You've got your rating. They're moving you to the jets. What were you flying those days?
Well, we went out to Williams Air Force Base in Phoenix. And that's where the jet training school was, and we trained in the F-80. Now, T-33s are the kind of the two-place F-80, and that's usually the lead-in for jet training is the T-33. But they only had two or three of those airplanes on the field, so we got one ride in the T-33, and then you went solo in the F-80. And I just love that F-80. I'm a small guy, and that's a small airplane, and I just felt like it had my name all over it.
What was it like flying the F-80? It sounds like it probably was a favorite airplane of yours.
Well, it really was. Yeah, naturally, that becomes, it's like your first girlfriend or your first wife in some cases. But, the F-80 was nice. It was the A model, the very basic. It didn't even have an ejection seat. It was just bolted to the floor. And it was a, pretty basic jet in those days. Starting it was kind of an exciting thing because sometimes it caught fire and sometimes it worked normally. But flying that jet, of course, it was at Williams Air Force Base in Arizona. It was the middle of summer, so of course it was just hotter than the devil out there, and so you got a real baptism of fire in terms of the weather that you had to put up with. and no air conditioning in that little dude, but it was just a great airplane.
So at the at that time, I have been at Williams now that it's been decommissioned, but did they have the 12,000-foot runways there at that time?
As I recall, we just had one runway. And no, I'm sure it wasn't 12,000 feet because they really didn't build them that length in those days. We didn't really have any big airplanes that needed that kind of a runway then. So I've been back to Williams since then. Of course, now, as you mentioned, it's a civilian field. And I've gone back in other airplanes and landed there, which is kind of interesting.
I just I was there for Copper State a number of years ago, and a gentleman took me out for a ride in an RV6. Which was great, but we landed on the longest of the runways, and you landed three or four times easily.
Yeah, it's a big runway now. Yeah.
So you've got your through your basic training and then overseas.
No, when I graduated from the F-80, of course, at that time, then you got your wings and you got your second lieutenant bars. So my first operational assignment then was to Albany, Georgia. Turner Air Force Base, another base that's no longer around. And I was assigned to the Strategic Air Command. Now, most people think of Strategic Air Command, SAC, as a bomber missile. And, of course, that is their primary business, or was. But they also had 6 or 7 fighter wings. And most people don't realize that in the 50s, General LeMay, who was SINGSAC, still wanted some fighter wings. And I think that was a holdover from World War II days where they had fighter escort. The bombers would go out on a mission. They'd always had the fighters along with them. In fact, we were called fighter escort wings. So it was a holdover from there, but obviously it became very impractical once nuclear weapons came into being and bombers no longer went on bomber streams. There was just every bomber was for himself. So there was no longer a need for that particular escort mission. So then they converted us when nuclear weapons became small. We became nuclear weapons carriers ourselves. So we had our own individual targets, and from that point on in SAC, we were weapons carrier just like the bombers were.
Well, you with that first assignment, then you did end up in Korea and flew quite a number of missions there.
Yeah, the Korean War was ongoing, of course, and so SAC, Strategic Air Command, got tapped to provide fighter pilots into the system. And so a bunch of us from Albany, Georgia, we were all second lieutenants, and we went over to Korea. We operated out of Daegu. The airfield number was K2. And the normal mission tour at that time was 100 missions, and then you go home. And we were having a lot of airplane troubles with, again, flying F-84s, which I was flying in SAC. And we were having a lot of airplane troubles over there, so it took a complete year to get those 100 missions in. Now, some people in F-86s or other organizations, they could go over and get 100 missions in 6 months and come home. But in our particular unit, things were going really slow, and so it took the full year to get the 100 combat missions.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking to Major General Pat Halloran about his career with the Air Force, the U-2, the SR-71, and some of the general aviation aircraft that that he's flown. And now you just mentioned having taken about a year to fly those 100 combat missions. Any of those missions stand out in your mental logbook?
Every one of them.
anyone highlighted more than another?
Yeah, there were a few exciting ones. I think I got shot up on 10 of the 100 missions where I got dead. But, you know, we're at the bottom of the food chain in that war. We were down doing the delivering weapons on the ground. No, it's air-to-ground stuff, bombing and shooting up trucks and stuff. And that was kind of a fun way to do it. But the MiGs, then their mission was to come down and get us because we were causing the damage. And the 86's mission was on top to get the MiGs. So it's kind of like a waterfall. We were in the bottom of the pole, and so that gave us some pretty exciting times. But we seldom got involved in big fights because the F-86s were up there doing their job. We did occasionally have to do some scrambling with MiGs, but most of our concerns were with ground fire. They had tremendous amounts of AAA and such. So all the damage that I received was from AAA fire and machine guns from the ground.
Well, you made it through your 100 missions and survived Korea, and then in, I believe, 1957, you transitioned out into the U-2.
Yeah, when I came back from Korea, I just returned to another SAC F-84 unit. So I was continued in SAC, and I was continuing flying the same airplanes, 84s. But then in the late 50s, of course, or mid-50s, the U-2 came into being. Now, we knew there was some kind of a program because you'd, every now and then you'd Aviation Week or something would have a little story about some mystery airplane that Lockheed was building, and so we all knew there was something going on, and we were all a little bit curious about it. And when the airplane then was about to become operational, a number of our pilots suddenly disappeared. You know, they just no checkout, they were just gone. And it turned out they were the ones that were, had been selected to join the CIA, which was the initial purpose of the U-2, and the CIA were the ones that actually ordered the first airplanes. The Air Force came out as a second customer. He had to be a reserve officer to go into the CIA because they discharged you from the Air Force. And I had just received a regular commission, of which I was very proud, and it turns out that because I got that, I couldn't go to the agency. I was called in for an interview with the agency, and he just opened my folder and says, "You're a regular." I said, "Yeah, very proud. Out of here." So that was my final short association with the agency. But after those guys disappeared, then we knew really that there was something going on. So SAC, under General LeMay, he decided that he was going to man the entire U-2 program, including the CIA guys. So everybody, 100% of the people that flew the U-2 in the early days were all SAC F-84 pilots. And we all knew each other from the various wings. But the agency guys had to go undercover, so we couldn't, if we saw them on the street, we couldn't talk to them. But the rest of us then, when the Air Force decided to buy the airplane, why, the various commanders within SAC were tapped to, you go kick in a couple of pilots. And so he would interview several of us that he thought would like that sort of thing. And I remember being interviewed by the commander, and he said, "I got this neat program. I think you'd like to go do it." I said, "What is it?" I can't tell you. "Well, where do we go or what do we fly?" "I can't tell you, but I think you'll like it." He says, "It's a single engine airplane." I said, "Well, that's good. Only one pilot." I said, "Okay, that's even better. And it's going to be extreme altitude. You're going to be wearing a spacesuit." I says, "Damn, we're going to be astronauts." Well, that disappeared as soon as we got down to Del Rio, Texas, where the U-2 program started for the Air Force. And first time we saw the airplane, it's, "Oh my God, you know, what is that?" But it turned out, of course, to be a lifesaver for my career.
All right, we're talking with Major General Pat Halloran, U-2 and SR-71 veteran, and a general aviation enthusiast as well. And we're going to take a break, be back in just a couple of minutes. From the Welcome Center, you're listening to EAA Radio.